Welcome, everyone. You're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Daphne Zohar, and my co-hosts today are Josh Schimmer, Bradlin Carr, John Mariganori, and Grace Colon. For more information about our hosts and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. At least six biotechs have filed for IPOs this month, reflecting what we've discussed as recent market optimism. The most recent to announce is autoimmune CAR T developer Kyverna, who's hoping to raise up to $100 million. And then bladder cancer focused CG Oncology is the first to have set terms. Josh, can you talk about Kyverna and then have Brad, we'll have Brad talk about CG?
Sure. So we've talked often on Hangout about the wave of CAR T therapeutics moving into the rheumatology, immunology space, nephrology as well, for autoimmune conditions with pretty dramatic results so far. Would also note that the physician community, despite it being extraordinarily early in data generation for these programs, tremendous awareness, tremendous enthusiasm, far more than I would have expected for any platform. It's at such an early stage, probably a testament to the unmet medical need combined with the very powerful results that we're seeing, like really, really dramatic disease resolution, very manageable safety profile. So I think many have been anticipating the Kyverna S1 to come out. You know, there's some relevant details in there. I think the debates going forward, as we think about the competitive landscape and dynamics, I think for the moment, it's fairly clear that it's Kyverna and Cabaletta that are in the lead. I think the S1 kind of is going to fuel the debate over who's really in the lead. You could argue for both companies, but I think really what will be most telling is the progress that they make enrolling patients and moving towards the registration enabling trials over the course of, you know, the next 6 to 12 months. And, you know, ultimately there's such a vast unmet medical need out there that it's unlikely that any 1, 2, 3, or even 4 companies are going to be able to satisfy the demand for these CAR-T therapies. As long as they remain autologous type derived, so we're going to be watching for perhaps some allogeneic type cell therapies or other approaches that might be more scalable. The other active debate is going to be whether there are better CAR T constructs or not, and that'll be defined both in part by efficacy and tolerability. In the Kyverna S1, we saw a couple, I think three. Grade 2 cases of cytokine release syndrome. That's perhaps a little bit more than what we've seen from other programs. They're a little bit more in the grade 1 field. Now, these are, you know, cross-trial comparisons, and so really not possible to make any definitive conclusions at this point. You know, the big difference for Kyverna versus some of the others is Kyverna uses the CD28 co-stim domain. Most of the others are using 4-1BB. There is an argument that 4-1BB just tends to have less cytokine release syndrome. Again, far from conclusive. So, you know, this is going to be a really exciting year for the field in general as these programs start to generate more comprehensive data sets. It gives us a chance to get clearer comparisons across programs, but ultimately keeping in mind, again, the point that there's tens and tens of thousands of these patients with unmet medical need. And, you know, there's likely to be more demand, at least over the near term, as these products come to market than any one company can satisfy.
Yeah, and then I'll take CG. So, you know, this one is previously filed and the IPO is coming up pretty soon. So they announced in regulatory filings that they're going to try to raise, I think, about $180 million. And this is an oncolytic virus for oncology. So their lead indication is non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. And one thing that's, I think, kind of an ironic asterisk is after COVID, nobody uses the term oncolytic virus anymore, as you can imagine, for obvious reasons. Like, no one wants to be injected with the virus. So they're calling them oncolytic immunotherapies. And, you know, as I think of the IPO market is like starting to get better, thankfully. I think the autoimmune cell therapies are kind of like in their own category because there's a bit of a mania going on there because of all of the exciting, you know, new data that we've seen. And also I would add that you just had the Gracell acquisition, and even though their lead program is a BCMA CAR T, I think a big part of that was actually the fact that they have an IND approved for lupus. And that's kind of its own thing. I think if you think about like the IPO market more broadly, that the stage that we're at in like the biotech cycle, hopefully, you know, early stages of the upswing, people are most focused on very late stage assets, you know, things that have, that are either in a registrational study or, you know, have achieved some proof of concept or something like that. And that kind of describes this company. So they're actually in a registrational study. So it's a very late stage program. And to me, that kind of seems like the sweet spot, whether it's oncology or anything else, of probably what we're going to see over, you know, the coming 6 months to a year. I think it's going to be a long time before, you know, we get back to the days of like preclinical companies or like totally unproven companies being able to IPO. But, you know, I think you'll see a lot more filings like this one. And so we'll have to see how it does. You know, the oncolytic virus space has kind of been up and down lately. We had a pretty high profile clinical trial disappointment in December in this space. So we'll have to see what investor appetite is for this one.
Yeah, it's true. It's cycled from preclinical platforms to, you know, no IPOs, and now, you know, beginning to see some of these later stage companies IPO. Before Grace and John, before I cover Alto Neuroscience, did you want to talk about any of the other IPOs or general market sentiment?
This is Grace. I'm happy to chime in on general market sentiment. I mean, I think you guys have probably covered this extensively in recent biotech hangouts, but just seeing the favorable trends, I think, driven by a lot of the things that we've been talking about. So the M&A, you know, increased investment in some of these early stage, you know, seeing some of these preclinical IPO filing for the first time in a long time, right? There were no preclinical IPOs last year. So I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see what we see for the rest of this quarter. But it's consistent with all the excitement we're seeing in biopharma around immunology, around neurology, and then some of these earlier stage new platform companies, I think, are finally going to have perhaps a resurgence with opportunity to get some financing and maybe even get out there. So, you know, it's going to be pretty exciting to see in the next few months.
I agree. John, did you want to comment on general market sentiment or any of the IPOs that are filed?
You know, I would echo what Grace just said. I think we're entering a more favorable environment, even with the last week or so of sort of post JPM swoon. I think the sentiment is going to be encouraging for 2024, and you know, obviously, you know, we'll have some headwinds related to upcoming election and so forth that we'll have to navigate through. But I think in general, just, you know, the prospects of interest rates coming down, which, you know, despite, you know, one recent sort of report, everybody still feels confident about. That's what's really going to drive a more favorable environment for our industry. And let's not forget, you know, last year we saw, you know, 55 FDA approvals. We saw the best M&A year ever, putting aside, you know, past big mega merger years like Pfizer, Wyeth, and so forth. But that's amazing. Those are really positive fundamentals for the sector. So I'm optimistic.
Yeah, that's great to hear. And one of the IPOs that caught my attention this week, or the IPO filings, is Alto Neurosciences. It's a mid-stage CNS biotech, which filed for an IPO on the NYSE. I think they have the benefit of the excitement around neuroscience with the two big neuro acquisitions announced at year end. Alto is an interesting company because it started with the concept of AI-enabled biomarkers as diagnostics, and they've pivoted now to drug development. And I want to talk broadly about digital biomarkers in a moment. Alto is now using the technology, which includes EEG and wearables, to stratify patients and match them to resurrected kind of old neuro drugs. I think the idea of precision neuroscience is very exciting, though Alto may run into questions around their business model, lack of composition of matter IP protection on their drugs, and the practical issues for prescribers, like the necessity of a companion biomarker or diagnostic in order to prescribe the drug. But it's really kind of a cool story in any case. And the drive toward digital and AI-informed biomarkers will inevitably expand to all areas of medicine. This week, the FDA cleared two different AI diagnostic tools: an AI clinical test for Alzheimer's called BrainSea, which uses standard brain MRI scans and predicts a patient's chance of progressing from mild cognitive impairment to Alzheimer's disease and dementia within 5 years. The FDA also cleared this week a digital biomarker that uses AI to analyze chest CT scans for the signs of IPF and to differentiate IPF from other lung diseases without invasive biopsies. So, in my opinion, we're at the low-hanging fruit stage of these biomarkers. So you're using the machine-aided analysis of existing data from MRI or CT images. And it's the stuff that we as an industry can do right now, know how to do. These biomarkers, I think, could be useful in clinical trials, of course, and in practice. But what's really intriguing is also the next generation of digital biomarkers, which are going to use new signals. For example, one that we worked on at PureTech is voice, to broaden the reach and capabilities. So while this area is really exciting, I wanted to open this up for discussion because I do think it needs to be grounded in clinical data, and we need to be aware of the risks of black box AIs, which could make a clinical decision like this child has cancer or this woman has Alzheimer's. And if we don't fully understand how it's making that decision, you know, that could obviously be problematic. The biomarkers also could lead to noise or build on biases, for example, underrepresenting a particular demographic group in the training data, meaning that the algorithms won't work as well on certain people. And it's also going to be sort of a challenging space to regulate. I'm curious to hear from the rest of the group, and I'll start with Grace on digital biomarkers.
Sure, happy to comment on that. This is an area I've long been involved with a number of companies. And I do think, you know, on that latter question you just raised about underserved populations, we saw an example of that with oxygen monitors, where they'd been trained on lighter skin, so they weren't giving accurate assessment in African-American populations or any population with a kind of a darker skin. And that's something that I think people are beginning to be much more aware of, developers, with respect to AI tools and imaging tools and all kinds of things where you might see differences that are not initially being captured with respect to different population types that have different risk. I think the idea, the two you just mentioned, so there's the there's one for Alzheimer's that that you had mentioned that is looking at, you know, obviously the PET scans, the BrainSea, but then also diseases like IPF that are difficult to diagnose and have a huge unmet need. Being able to have these tools to not only diagnose, so it has clinical actionability and goes through that pathway and gets reimbursement like some of these are getting. But to me, the exciting part will be when we can integrate these and get validated biomarkers for advancing drug development. And that's obviously a longer path. We've seen that begin to be incorporated with specific biomarkers like neurofilament, but I think will be more interesting will be a combination of clinical biomarkers as well as wearables and digital. That's where I think we're going to begin to see a true step change in the industry. When I think of, for example, in cardiology with arrhythmia, being able to integrate monitoring of AFib events and really being able to quantify that to improve drug development and medical device development, that's something that we're beginning to see integrated a lot in that field. And also when you look at things like Dravet syndrome or rare epilepsy, where we know children are having thousands of micro events in a given month, but the current sort of manual scales that are being used by the parents are inadequate at capturing the true burden of the disease. So if we can begin to think about where are applications where you can integrate specific wearables or digital markers or even better patient apps to combine symptoms with clinical biomarkers, wet biomarkers, if you will, that I think will be enable not only better diagnosis and treatment and actually capturing the disease and stage of disease, but actually help in drug development. And I think we're going to begin to see a lot more of that. I think there were a lot of false starts when people got excited about health tech and digital biomarkers, but I do think we're beginning to see some practical applications of these.
For sure. And I think when we hear a lot of the excitement around AI in drug development, you're focused on drug discovery, and this whole area of digital biomarkers is another angle to that, which is quite intriguing. I don't know if Brad, John, or Josh would like to comment on this broader theme.
I'll jump in real quick. I visited Alto about a month ago, so they're just outside of Stanford. And I'm definitely not a CNS expert, but it really brought home to me like how much, without commenting on their company and their program specifically, like how much this approach makes sense. And I think where digital biomarkers are going to have a huge impact is patient selection and trials, because, you know, like I think their lead program, if I remember correctly, is depression. And it's totally insane to classify depression as one thing. Basically, there's a series of, you know, if you take a questionnaire, if you fall under a series of things, which can all be like very diverse and heterogeneous, you might be classified with depression. And the way I think of it as an oncology person is this is kind of like where oncology was decades ago when you thought of breast cancer as one thing. And now we know all of the different types of breast cancer, you know, HER2 positive, HER2 negative, all of that. That's what these types of diseases are going to be like in the future as we like better understand, you know, individual patient characteristics and understand that, you know, depression is not one thing. It's like 20 different things. And so if you can define, a quarter of the patients that might, you know, really respond to a specific drug rather than having a broad trial, I think it's just going to help the success rate in this field a lot in the years ahead.
Yeah, I mean, great comments from Grace and Brad. I would just add that when it comes to big data, you know, you always have to worry a little bit about the noise versus the signal, being able to replicate early observations, and then ideally being able to support, you know, if we're talking about patient segmentation using these tools, also being able to support it with some kind of biologic rationale to help validate that signal and distinguish it from noise. When it comes to AI-enabled drug development, I think one of the concerns that me and others have is that we're just in so far over our heads with really limited understanding of how AI works, how to distinguish higher quality AI from lower quality AI, really understanding the difference it can make in the process. I think in what we're talking about here is much more understandable, definable, relative to incorporating into the drug development landscape itself.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the challenges with some of these digital biomarker types of approaches is, you know, who is incentivized to actually run the placebo-controlled study to validate a biomarker? And that's, I think, a challenge that the industry's dealt with for years. So let's move on. Brad, can you talk about the FDA extending the approval of Vertex and CRISPR's Casgevy as the first CRISPR-edited therapy for beta thalassemia?
Yeah, so this approval came a little early, but, you know, it was highly expected. And, you know, I think it's going to be a tough commercial market. And I think really the opportunity, even though Bluebird has had a tough go of it, I think the opportunity for this is probably going to be more geared towards Europe commercially. You know, I think the issue here is that, you know, beta thalassemia is a really serious thing, but like compared to sickle cell, which is, you know, a truly serious, immediate unmet need, with beta thal, you have monthly transfusions. And I mean, iron builds up in your body and that can have a really bad impact over many years and decades. But, you know, we have all read a lot over the previous months about how serious it is to sign up for these cell therapies for these hemoglobinopathies, because you have to go through the chemo preconditioning and all of that so that, you know, the cells can be reinfused and grafted in your bone marrow. And so I think that while this is a serious condition, and this is, you know, going to be a good alternative for some people compared to monthly transfusions, I think this is going to be a little bit of a different commercial market than sickle cell is going to be. So it's, you know, it's obviously another historic moment. You know, now we have two approvals, but, you know, like from a stock market perspective, like it was kind of a yawn and everything. And I think from a commercial opportunity, it would be surprising if this like really takes off. So we'll have to watch it.
Brad and Josh, can you guys talk about the interim data that was reported by RegenxBio around their gene therapy program for vision loss? It's partnered with AbbVie.
Yeah, I'll just quickly set it up. And I think Josh knows way more about this than I do. It's pretty straightforward. This is a gene therapy that's meant to be a one and done compared to like the Eylea's of the world in wet AMD. And there's kind of two issues here. So first of all, like when you have something that's been on the market and is like, you know, used safely as long as the anti-VEGFs have, when you have a gene therapy competing with a traditional therapy, people are going to look at safety very closely. And so this was like some mid-level data. It was like a 6-month follow-up and some more dose cohorts that they announced. And I think the most important thing that people were looking at is safety and whether there was any inflammation or anything like that. And it actually looked pretty clean. And then from like an efficacy standpoint, people are watching like, what is the real world utility of this? And so compared to the VEGF treatments, like these patients who are, of course, were on VEGF treatments, had 80% reduction in the number of, you know, visits that they had to get injections. And I think there was, in the highest dose cohort, 50% of patients didn't require any injections at all. So this is something to watch. And, you know, from a commercial standpoint, though, now, like, you also have high-dose Eylea on the market. And so the convenience factor maybe is a little less than the way it's portrayed here is like one and done versus monthly injections. And so we'll have to see. But, you know, I think these types of indications are really interesting because, you know, in some other areas like cardiomyopathy, you have all of these different modalities, like these new things that we're talking about, like gene therapies, RNAi, you know, things like that, starting to compete in like really broad indications and like, you know, really big markets. And so I think it's really interesting to see how some of these new technologies stand up against, you know, what we consider more traditional things. So this was still a mid-level study. Like this company, and they're partnered with AbbVie on this, will still have to run a pivotal trial, I believe. And so it's still like years away, but interesting data nonetheless. Josh, do you want to take it from there?
Yeah, great characterization of the data, maybe for some context, because I followed the wet AMD space dating back to Macugen. Trivia question for those who remember which company developed Macugen and then what company
iTech.
Acquired. Yeah, and then what company acquired iTech? I remember that one.
Pfizer, I think.
OSI Pharmaceuticals.
So one of the worst acquisitions ever, I think.
certainly at the time. So there's a real challenge when it comes to wet AMD drug development. In the early studies, there's tremendous heterogeneity of patients and their disease severity, very hard to adjust for across clinical trials, and it's really important, and it limits the ability to really draw definitive conclusions from the early stage trials. Then when you get to the late stage trials, there's tremendous gaming of trial designs to make drugs look way better than they are. Probably one of the worst offenders that I've seen actually was high dose Eylea, that they wind up comparing a PRN as needed, kind of shifting dosing regimen of one drug compared to a fixed dosing schedule of the standard of care, 2 milligrams Eylea, and then kind of point to endpoints that you can't really draw meaningful conclusions off of. And when you talk to some of the retina specialists about their experience with high dose Eylea, it's not really what they were expecting based on the data. We've seen this time and time again in the phase 3 trials. So I think we're starting to see perhaps more discipline in phase 3 trial designs and drug development in wet AMD, which is encouraging. Ocular Therapeutics has kind of an interesting SPA design for their longer acting intravitreal therapy. But ultimately, the point being that we wind up looking at apples, oranges, and watermelons and not really able to clearly discern the value of a product often until it just gets into the hands of clinicians. Some of that, I think, perhaps intentionally from a marketing perspective. But, as companies are kind of moving into an evolving and shifting landscape of wet AMD, I think there's a little bit more pressure on them to come up with more robust and interpretable data sets. So we've got a few intravitreal or subchoroidal wet AMD gene therapies. There's Regenix, who just posted their AVA data. That's the suprachoroidal approach. And then at the Angiogenesis Foundation meeting in February, we're going to get some updates from 4D and Adverum. And we're going to have to try to figure out how to compare all of these data sets, if even possible, recognizing that some of the baseline demographics are really, really important for interpreting and extrapolating data.
Hey, Josh, since we're on the topic of ophthalmology, do you want to touch on Wiley Chambers retiring?
Yeah, so after a very long tenure as the director of the ophthalmology division, Wiley Chambers is stepping down. From my perspective, watching some of the decisions that he's made in a somewhat dictatorial fashion have not really aligned with current standard of care or optimal patient management or even optimal drug development. He was, when you have a division head who is mononymous, known throughout the ophthalmology community as well, you start to wonder if some division heads do have disproportionate influence and power over a field. And we've seen time and time again very frustrating division heads at the FDA. A reminder that at the end of the day, there are people that are making these decisions, and there are often very subjective views behind those decisions. And we can very respectfully agree to vehemently disagree with some of the policies that get put in place. So it'll be very interesting to see who takes over as the head of ophthalmology and if drug development changes as a result. Personally, I'm hoping it does.
Does anyone want to take the other side of that? No? Okay.
Well, I would just say, not to take another side to it per se, and I haven't put a program into Wiley's division, but notwithstanding Josh's points, I think the ophthalmology division has been a division that's been more oriented toward innovation than many other divisions in the FDA. I mean, one of the big issues I think we all face with FDA, as much as there's been remarkable improvements over the years, is sort of interdivisional differences in how they look at benefit risk and how they think about new innovative products and ways of doing clinical studies. And, you know, I think Wiley, actually, the reputation of that division has been pretty favorable in that regard, all things considered. So I would just add that sort of quote unquote counterpoint to what Josh said.
Yeah, and I think that what you were pointing out in terms of the people and how influential they are, you think about Billy Dunn in the neuroscience side of things, and it really does stand out. And it's I think probably more problematic when the official is anti-industry or kind of more difficult to work with as opposed to the opposite. But, I think very interesting points here. So let's go to some of the news around the private funding side of things. We had a report that came out, and Bruce Booth was talking about it. This was a report from Silicon Valley Bank analyzing investments and exit trends in biopharma. And I'd love to have Grace and John walk us through that and talk about any implications and also what you guys are seeing in the private funding community.
Grace, do you want to start?
Sure, I'll start. Yeah. So in terms of what's interesting in the report is we're seeing that if you actually look at venture funding, you know, which is actually kind of startling to me, it wasn't that reduced with respect to, the all-time high of $28 billion in 2021. So overall, it was $19 billion, which doesn't sound, sounds like a big drop, but actually 2020 was 17, and that was an all-time high, right? So I think we're seeing consistency. I think we're probably going to surpass that number this year. The other thing that was interesting, but I guess not surprising, was the percentage of deals that didn't disclose what the valuation change was, right? So we knew that we were seeing a lot of flattened down rounds, but actually 67% are not disclosing what the valuation is. And clearly, a lot of companies went through this, a lot of companies that raised their crossovers and sort of the heyday of 21 have not gotten out. We're going to see this huge backlog of companies that are trying to get out, and they had to compromise, and their investors had to sort of take a huge hit and take some write downs. And a lot of investors double down on their existing portfolios. So we're seeing kind of the fallout from that. We're seeing that a lot of these spoon-fed deals got done, which is really not a very big deal, after somebody who's worth, I believe the metric was over 20 million valuation around, that was about 15 million or so on average. Basically just keeping the companies alive. Companies were forced to restructure, they were forced to double down on their lead programs. And so we saw a lot of, I think, healthy shifting in the industry. I think a little bit of restructuring. Some of the early stage funds were focusing on later stage. They were going for even in some cases deals on the public market where they could get some way undervalued deals. So I think all of that shifting is probably generally good news going forward. We saw a lot of a lot of companies unfortunately have to wind down. But I think now we're beginning to see a shift in early stage funding. I'm hearing good news from people getting early stage deals done. What's interesting is there's more interest in early stage platform deals. That's what I'm hearing from my fellow CEOs and entrepreneurs, is there's a resurgence in interest in some of these earlier stage, kind of taking a chance on some of these new platforms. So, John, I don't know if you're hearing something different.
No, I think I'm hearing similar things, and I think there is interest in platforms to the extent that those platforms are product engines. I think that's important at the end of the day. But the other parts of the report, and Bruce, tweeted about this, which I think is really interesting, is over the last 3 years. There's been about $70 billion of venture capital that's been raised. And it just sort of speaks to the amazing investment powder that now exists in the hands of people that need to deploy it into private companies for the most part, which I think is an exciting, is really exciting to think about. And, you know, a lot of the companies that will get born over the next period of time will be, you know, remarkable vintage companies from the standpoint of how they can deliver value to investors. If in fact we're coming out of a negative cycle, which I believe we are in this year and to the next few years. So that'll be an exciting thing to watch and see what type of companies get funded and, you know, where those companies, once they get funded, go from a you know, medical impact standpoint, but also ultimately value creation as well.
John, we had Peter Kolchinski on a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about this, I think he called it like the crossover funding conveyor belt. And this, I think the idea that you, the companies get funded by top tier sort of biotech investors, the crossovers come in, and then these companies IPO. How much do you think is, you know, do you anticipate that will restart sort of that conveyor belt, and how much do you think the quality of the syndicate sort of dictates the performance of an IPO?
Well, I think that's gonna restart increasingly. I think right now a lot of the quote unquote crossovers continue to look at opportunities that are just, you know, way beaten up on the public market side, where they can get access to liquidity right away. But I think increasingly there's a focus, especially for higher quality private companies, where there's a real attraction to getting in at a lower valuation and being able to ride it into the IPO. And I've been advising my companies that are post Series A and thinking about the next, you know, 2 years of funding to think a lot about investors that can come into their syndication that are going to participate in public markets ultimately, whether those, you would call them classical crossover investors or just people that participate in public market investing, is a matter of semantics. But I think that is going to be happening more and more, especially now as we start seeing the return of the IPO markets.
Yeah. Also on the private funding side of things, our colleague Bernard Ole wrote a nice piece in the Timmerman Report. And he was basically talking about how, you know, an entrepreneur or CEO will spend a lot of time with an investor and then will get sort of very high level feedback. You know, it might just be a polite, you know, it's too early or, you know, something like that. But, you know, how important it is to provide feedback to CEOs. And I see Bernat's in the audience. I don't know, Bernat, if you could raise your hand up. We were trying to invite you up. I'm not sure it didn't work. But I don't know if anybody read the piece and what your thoughts are on, you know, providing feedback in general. And, you know, do people really want the feedback? Do you end up getting yourself in trouble? And also, you know, both private and public side of things. And I'll open that up to Grace.
Yeah, I loved the article, Bernat, and I saw him on the audience as well. I completely concur with that. I Daphne, like you, you know, we mentor, and I know John does too, a lot of, you know, first-time entrepreneurs. And I always, they're always hesitant to go talk to investors. Oh, I'm not ready. It's too early. And I have, as Bernat mentioned in his article, a lot of great investors who were always willing to meet and have a cup of coffee, even if you're not ready. And that feedback is gold. And they're also good about providing feedback about why they're not investing. And it's really important to take that into account, because those are the people you're going to be going to for funding later. So I thought his advice to investors to be willing to do that, to be willing to be candid, not take the easy way out and say, oh, well, we're just prioritizing something else. You know, tell the entrepreneur why you're not going to invest, provide a nugget of advice, take that time. It'll come, you know, and he gave some great examples of investors who had done that, came back later and led later rounds. So I do think that's important. And I do think that some of the best investors probably spend a large chunk of their time doing that, just building those relationships with entrepreneurs. You know, they see so many different types of companies in that particular area of expertise, for example, and they can say, here, you know, here are the milestones we would need to see. Here's why you're not ready. And here's what we think is fundable. So I thought that was really helpful. It's a message we should all be reinforcing, because it is an ecosystem, right? And both sides can be successful if there's just that network and that communication.
Yeah, I thought the article was great. I completely agree with what Grace just said. I do think we have to really push on investors to be candid about advice or views on why they passed or why they didn't proceed, and in some cases, obviously, when they do proceed, they're more forthright in terms of providing the feedback of what was compelling to them in their investment thesis. But I really think it's important for the investors. Maybe we create a Yelp system where we can all, as the entrepreneurs, we can all rate investors based on the feedback and the quality of the feedback they provide everybody. And we can use that as a tool amongst us entrepreneurs. But at the end of the day, it's really, really important. And I hope we see more of it from the investment community when they work with entrepreneurs.
Yeah, there was this guy, I can't remember what it was called, but he was like, it was called Founder something, but he did try to rate and grade, the investors. I don't remember what happened to that. It was pretty interesting. But there is sort of this power dynamic between investors and founders, which is, it's obviously skewed, especially in markets where it's a buyer's market. But then it cycles too, right? And people remember how they were treated when they were in that sort of weaker position. And so I think that it's just smart business to provide that feedback and to build those relationships over time, even if you don't think you're going to invest in a company at that particular point.
And the dividends it pays from an ecosystem standpoint are just profound. I mean, you want to create an ecosystem where there's learning and where things get better and better and better over time. And the entrepreneurs comes forward with a more, financeable business plan in the future, as opposed to, something which is, not fundable. So that is something which serves everybody's best interests at the end.
For sure. So it looks like Bernard is having some trouble connecting. We've been trying to get him up, and it looks like there's like a technical issue here. So Bernard, if you figure it out, we'll ask you to comment. But in the meantime, we'll move on to a few other items. So BridgeBio announced a financing from Blue Owl Capital and CPP Investments, bringing in up to $1.25 billion. The financing comes ahead of the potential launch of acoramidis as a treatment for ATTR cardiomyopathy. And what I found interesting about this deal and just in general over the last few years is how important these royalty and project financing deals are turning out to be. They're less dilutive in the near term. They obviously hit the overall upside, but this was an interesting deal. The royalty agreement includes a $500 million cash payment on FDA approval in exchange for future royalties of 5% of worldwide net sales. And they cap it at 1.9 times the investment capital. And then the other positive aspect of this deal is that BridgeBio is refinancing, extending some of that senior credit facility. So they're extending it by 3 years. So I thought that was pretty interesting in general. And I think we see Bernard. Nope, he's not up here. So that was pretty intriguing. I don't know if any of you guys have been following these, but I would love to have some of the royalty players up here at some point to talk about these deals that they're doing. They've just become a much more attractive and interesting source of capital.
Daphne, we did at Alnylam, we did a $2 billion royalty financing where, we monetized half of our royalties that were due to us through Novartis's acquisition of Medicines Company. And, it was just a fantastic deal. We did that with Blackstone. But, it's really, once you get your portfolio to a late enough stage where you can participate in this method of raising capital, it is just such a wonderful tool for the company builder to deploy, especially when they need that modicum of capital toward, as they're closer to commercialization themselves, where they can benefit from a product that might have been partnered with a pharma or their own product, as in the case of BridgeBio, where they're willing to pay, you know, this 5% royalty. And it's capped as well. It's capped at a certain, you know, ROI for the royalty investors. So it is a really terrific option for, you know, the company builders out there. Again, when they get their portfolios and their pipeline late enough stage to warrant that consideration. Often the rule has been, oh, you got to wait till you're on the market for those type of deals. But increasingly, you're seeing deals getting done before product approval. And that's what we did with Leqvio. It was before the FDA approved Leqvio. And that's what BridgeBio did with Acoramidis. It was before the approval. And that's good to see. And there's also a lot more players out there now. I didn't even know who Blue Owl was, but it's great. And good to see more players in that mix as well.
Yeah, and I can comment on that as well. I looked at this extensively for one of my prior companies. And what's interesting, John, you know, you mentioned the sort of either commercial or pre-commercial waiting for approval. I was seeing more and more actually pre-phase three, but obviously it depends on the asset. It depends on the risk and the expectation of success. And what's really interesting is, you know, obviously if you're going that early, so players like NovaQuest were doing those types of deals, Royalty Pharma was doing some of those, and they're harder to come by. And it's typically a 3.5 to 4x cap. And the challenge with that one is really negotiating when the key milestones come in. Because if it's at a stage you're going to go out for financing or you're looking to do a crossover IPO, investors are really wary of those big milestones. So we had actually had all kinds of models where you could move the milestones around and sort of back end it more to a point where investors would get comfortable. So I definitely agree it's a great option. It is available for earlier stage, but the devil's in the details for those.
So I see Bernat is up here. Bernat, would you like to talk at all about your Timmerman report piece and just anything else that we've commented on today?
Yes, thanks, Daphne. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. Sorry, this is my first time using the X Spaces. So yeah, the genesis to write this for Luke was my own experiences and discussions with many other entrepreneurs, young and veteran, and a shared sense that in too many of the investor-entrepreneur discussions, there's nothing learned by the entrepreneur, nothing gained by the investor, because no candid feedback is shared. A recognition that we all know this is a problem, but somehow we accept this as normal, and it should not be normal. It starts with often the entrepreneur not specifically asking or insisting for the feedback, the investor not wanting to be candid about it, and it ends with the entrepreneur learning nothing from the interaction, the investor missing the chance to earn the trust of the entrepreneur for future encounters, a tremendous amount of time being wasted, and we all as an industry being dumber for it. And so in the piece, I try to go into why I think it's important to give it, some of my own personal examples of when I've got it and it's been precious. I think especially early in your career, because the benefits of good feedback compound over time. It's like money in the bank. You know, if you can learn about good habits and bad habits early on, it's a lot more helpful than if it takes years to learn. I also try to do a little bit of psychoanalysis from discussions with investor friends of why they're choosing not to give candid feedback and how they rationalize it to themselves and basically take issue with some of the key reasons, such as I don't have time for this, or I think it's too risky to share the feedback because I may alienate the entrepreneur, or I would rather wait and see if the round gets hot and then try to get in rather than, you know, maybe shoot myself in the foot by giving feedback, or I don't think the entrepreneur is going to be able to handle it. There's a number of those reasons. And, you know, over the years, I've come to appreciate that I don't think any of those are the real reasons. I think that the real reasons are that it's hard. It's just easier not to give it. It takes courage. Often the entrepreneurs don't ask for it. and crucially, that there's not a built-in mechanism to reward the rare investors that choose to give in. And so that was also a little bit of a call to action to entrepreneurs to find ways to reward it when you see it. And I make a reference to a teaching from Jack Welch, the former CEO of General Electric. I had the good luck of having him as a teacher at MIT. And he was a big, big proponent of candor, perhaps the most lucid person I've seen on the topic. And he used to say, to get candor, you reward it, you praise it, you talk about it, you make public heroes of the people who demonstrated. And we don't have a way to do that as a community of entrepreneurs, and we should. You know, we should tell our fellow entrepreneurs about the investors that do that, and we do that. But you know, consider going farther, making these investors your first call when you have your next set of data or when a term sheet comes in, creating essentially a real incentive for the behavior that we seek. So these are some of the things I talk on in the piece.
Yeah, I think that candor is one of the things that is important to incentivize. And another one, and I wonder, you know, sometimes people at this point about like waiting to see if the round gets hot. But like, I definitely think that incentivizing those investors that are willing to step in early, that sort of have their own vision and view and just come in and rather than the ones who are followers. So that's definitely a behavior that I think it's good to incentivize. Josh, yeah. Did you have any comment? I'd love to hear from you. You know, how often do you provide feedback? And you're not an investor, but you have a really broad and deep perspective. And also, Brad, you know, how often do you guys provide feedback that's specific? And I also wonder, like, some of the feedback is probably personal. Like, you just didn't click with the team, or you didn't trust the team. I wonder, you know, how helpful that feedback would be. Josh, you want to go first? All right, I don't know.
Sorry, I was just having a hard time getting unmuted there. You know, my challenge is as you may be able to figure out, I tend to be a little too unfiltered, and do try, at least when asked, to provide feedback, and it can be in terms of, you know, the programs itself. Sometimes there's just poor chemistry in the room, and that's kind of it. And given the number of companies out there for analysts or investors to work with, you know, very high quality companies, you know, you can be a little bit more choosy with the and picky with the ones that you do want to engage with further, especially in this market dynamic when there's just so much opportunity out there. Well, one thing I'd add, though, is that, you know, a lot of times we just don't know, right? Or we don't have a strong opinion to even share. Maybe we're a little new to the story, we're not familiar. And so to provide any strong feedback or guidance, you know, just doesn't seem right because we're not fluent enough. And you know, if you're not fluent enough, you may not be able to come to an investment decision, but on the other hand, you're not necessarily going to have any obvious criticism that you want to provide to the company. You know, you want to encourage the innovators and be supportive of innovators. And so a lot of times we're just in the dark. So perhaps some of the lack of feedback comes from that dynamic. And, you know, maybe we need to do a better job articulating when we're in that setting. But you know, again, there are the social considerations, and this is. These the cycles are very long cycles, and to some extent, it's a relationship-driven industry as well. So it's a delicate balance.
Bernard, did you want to say something?
Yeah, that's a good category that Josh brought up, and I realize it's one that I missed from the ones that I listed. You know, the situation where investor maybe the analyst doesn't necessarily feel like they know enough to give feedback, but and therefore that the entrepreneur might be like, hey, I didn't ask you for it, which can also be alienating. But I think that again, if the entrepreneur asks for it, you don't really have to know more than him or her to provide it. And just saying, look, these are parts of the story that I maybe didn't understand, that already is helpful feedback. I think at the end of the day, a lot of the non-share feedback, both on the side of the entrepreneur and the investor, comes from, people on either side caring more about ego and less about learning, rather than the other way around, caring more about learning and less about the ego. So if you're more driven by the learning, you'll ask for the feedback and hopefully you'll listen. And if you're the investor and you're also less concerned about your ego and being wrong, you'll probably have less of an issue in saying, look, I may be wrong about this, and I realize you may know a lot more about this, but this is what came across to me in the discussion. And that already can be very useful feedback as well.
Yeah, that's a very good point in terms of, you know, the importance of, you know, putting ego aside in general to make the right decisions. And it's a trait that I think is useful in leadership in general. So we only have a few minutes left, and I'd like to go around the room and have people make closing remarks. Brad, just before we do that, you were one of the first people to predict that Vivek Ramaswamy would run for president. What do you think of him dropping out now?
I think he's going to be the vice presidential pick. And the reason I think that is because I don't think he's strategically the best choice for Trump, because like you saw the percentage of vote that he got in Iowa and that he would have received in other states. But the thing that matters most to Donald Trump is like who's nicest and most complimentary to him. And that's Vivek by like a mile. And so I wouldn't be surprised. In fact, I'll predict right now that he ends up being the vice presidential pick. So that's, I didn't put out predictions this year, like my top 10, like I normally do. So I'll just have one prediction this year that he ends up getting chosen for that.
You're not off the hook though. You got to put out your predictions that are really good. But we'll keep you on for that. Yeah, I agree with that. So let's go around. Any closing remarks? Let's go to Josh next.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a little bit of cooling off of the sector post JP Morgan. Not at all surprising, given one of the strongest quarters and fourth quarter that we've ever seen. The aggregation of large M&A deals that were done in December, which I think is probably going to be a recurring theme. Like December is the time for the big deals now, given some of the accounting rule changes for IP R&D. And it's a healthy little pause, but still tremendous opportunity out there in biotech land. I think this is maybe not my favorite time ever for finding opportunity in biotech. That would have been 3 months ago. But we've been in places like this before, and if you're looking in the right places, you know, there's, as I said, just tremendous innovation. Kudos to the industry and the innovators. I think the pause in the IPO windows help private companies advance, mature, and kind of filter out the higher quality names. So very bright future for the industry.
I agree. John, go to you, and then Grace, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about the amicus brief that's being advanced right now.
Yeah, I'll just be real quick because I want Grace to have time on the amicus. I think this post JPM swoon in the capital markets is to be expected given how much it sort of bounced back in the Q4 period. And you know, we're off to better days ahead of us. So, and I think this industry is a lot stronger now for lots of different reasons. And I commented on that recently, but ultimately, we build stronger companies, after we've learned, in a negative cycle, what was not working. And, that's good for all of us. Josh, over to you or whoever's next, or Grace, over to you.
Sure. I know we only have a couple minutes, and I think probably most listeners are hopefully at least familiar with what's going on with mifepristone, which was a drug approved back in 2000 as part of an abortion regimen for prior to 10 weeks gestation in combination with misoprostol. So the issue has been that a court in Texas tried to overturn basically, start leading towards overturning the approval of this drug, first by increasing restrictions to access and bumping back some things on the label that allowed broader access. And this has bounced back and forth. It was bounced up to the Fifth Circuit, and it's going in front of the Supreme Court in a few months. And so a number of folks in the biotech industry I think we're alarmed by this, regardless of sort of the issue of abortion. It's really about the fact that a local judge, a partisan judge, decided that they were going to rule on the safety and effectiveness of basically a drug that had been approved by the FDA. And so this is quite concerning, because this could have serious implications for drug approval going forward. For partisan reasons, a judge could question the judgment of the FDA. And so this really, you know, their ruling distorted the evidence and really second guesses the FDA scientific judgment. And so a number of the industry have come together with a law firm in DC, actually a former FDA person, Eva Temkin, a partner at a law firm, who has put together this amicus brief, which is very, very focused on the issue of the scientific judgment, overturning it by a local judge. And I think, you know, they even basically don't talk about monitoring. They talk about a number of things that are really nitty gritty with respect to what the FDA said was possible. And we are collecting signatures from CEOs and investors to actually really pack more punch to the amicus brief when it goes in front of the Supreme Court. We actually heard from insiders that they actually really read and are impacted by what the industry is saying. I think they've done a really good job on the amicus brief to really make it around the scientific process and FDA jurisdiction. If you're interested, you could reach out to me. I think many of you have signed already. We're really looking for CEOs and investors and other industry experts to be able to support this. So I know we're out of time now, so please feel free to follow up if you'd like more information. We can send you some articles that have a lot more information, as well as a copy of the amicus.
Yeah, so, and we can try to share a link as well. So we'll share a link and also your contact info, Grace, and let people follow up with you. So yeah, I encourage people to sign on, especially CEOs of companies. I know that like a couple of big pharma companies have signed on, so that would be terrific. Big pharma, big biotech, small biotech CEOs. Thanks, Grace, for describing it. And I think we're out of time. So thanks to all of the co-hosts today and to Bernard for being good sport and coming up in an impromptu way. And wish you all a great weekend. Look forward to seeing you next week on Biotech Hangout.